Our Beer Could Be Your Life is brought to you by Smoke and Dagger Black Lager. From the darkest depths of the void comes a beer cloaked in mystery.
So mysterious.
Brewed with traditional old world ingredients and cutting edge lagering techniques.
It's a lager.
The perfect balance of old and new, dark yet light and drinkable. Smoked malt and 25 IBUs.
Smoke and Dagger.
Perfected by Jacksabby Brewing in Framingham, Massachusetts. When the void stares back, tell it you're drinking Smoke and Dagger.
This week on Our Beer Could Be Your Life, we sat down with Keith Kirchhoff and talked all things compositional and classical in craft beer. We had a great, really probably the deepest beer conversation we've had on the show thus far, which was a lot of fun. How are you guys doing today?
Guys, we made it to 10 episodes! 10th episode special! They said we'd never make it past number 9, but guys, we made it to number 10.
This is our 10th and final episode. As of the sound effect, I'm out.
I'm retiring immediately.
Is that a kazoo?
I have no idea what it is. It's just a thing that makes a whirly noise.
Yeah. I know it's not a kazoo. Yeah,
you said that with a lot of authority, actually. Like, I would imagine out of sight that
is a kazoo's over here.
Understood. That's a kazoo. Good, good. The kazoo is for episode 20, which at this rate with the sound effects, we may never get there.
The kazoo is a staple if you have to mimic a like drive-through window. Like,
hey, dude, what's going on? Can I take your order, please?
Like, that's what it's for in this medium.
How often does that come up?
It just came up, Joe.
That's so true. Well, welcome to a podcast drive-through of culture where we learn about neoclassical music. No, he didn't say neoclassical, new classical music. Progressive music with Keith and not progressive beer, really old, dusty, delicious Belgian beer.
Yeah, this was definitely my favorite beer drinking episode because we got to drink Westy and or not Vestlettering, but Vestmalle and Saison DuPont, which are just two classic and absolutely amazing beers.
Yeah, I think that they qualify both as world-class beers within their style. For nerds like us, they are really exemplars of what they are. I think Westmalle was the first triple. That fact is ringing around somewhere in the dusty corners of my brain. Saison DuPont is obviously the standard that we hold all Saisons to. So two good beers to drink and talk about, like, what, I mean, I asked the dumb question of like, what is classical music? So that gets answered in here. You laugh because you haven't heard the answer. Keith said it was a good question, Dennis.
I'm sure.
It was a great question. It was an amazing
he didn't
question.
Say it was a great question. He said it was a good question.
I think very highly of you, Joe, and your questions. So
great. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. Then I was leaving you space to speak there, Dennis. If you wanted to also compliment me, you could have done so. You could edit it back in there if you want.
Yeah,
just a little bit more work for you, but that's where you would want to put a compliment for me is right after Oz gave me a compliment. You could have come in.
I could have
given me a compliment.
Right.
Yeah. We'll just fix it in post, as they say.
Yeah,
you know?
Of course. Sure. Yep. Yeah. Yep.
So Joe, what are you drinking over there? You're pretty feisty today. I like it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm drinking a summer seasonal, a soon-to-be-released Jacksabby summer seasonal called Raycatcher, because I got 3 inches of snow today. And when we sat with Travis of Piebald and we talked about how it was fake spring, I think we got fake winter, which must be the inverse of fake spring, which means that we're going to be in warm weather soon.
Yeah, it'll probably be like 95 degrees and humid out tomorrow, and then it'll probably snow again on Sunday or Monday or something.
Yeah, you know, New England.
It's true. I love where I live. I did not love having to move 3 inches of slush off my car in the middle of the day today. That was an unexpected delight. So Raycatcher is like a rice lager brewed lemongrass. It's pretty tasty.
Yeah, it's really good.
It's very simple, very pretty. I like it. How about you guys? What do you
really well balanced?
We do that, right?
We do that. I am drinking the Saison DuPont that Matt gave me yesterday. Yeah, it Belgian farmhouse. It just like smacks of that Belgian yeast character, and it's delicious.
I'm kind of jealous I don't have any of those left. I drank both of them last night. It was a mistake.
Was that a this morning mistake that you discovered?
No, this morning was fine. Three beers wasn't enough to knock me out, even though the triple was like 10%, but I was fine.
I haven't cracked the triple yet. Last night we recorded this and I had the Saison DuPont, which is like 6.5%. I hadn't eaten dinner yet. And I was like, if I drink this 10% beer on this podcast, shit is going left. And so I didn't. But that means tonight I can let shit go left. So, you know, we usually say Happy Friday. Now we can say Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
Yeah. What else did you find interesting about this conversation? I thought, not to go back to exactly what I just mentioned, but the definition of classical music as like a studied thing and something that you compose for others to perform really just kind of like bent my brain in a good shape. Never really thought of that.
Yeah. I think there's a interesting way that he looks at, you know, he's fine with the term classical because there's a lot of refinement to it in the music that he makes. And I think that he takes a lot of pride in the stuff he does. And I think that translates to the way he feels about what he's doing. I was just, you know, impressed that he's been known. He's wanted to play the piano since he was like 3 years old, he said. When I can feel like I haven't known what I want to do with anything for the last 3 days.
I still don't know what I want to do when I grow up.
I encourage you both and myself often to not, you know, get so hung up on what you want to do in the end and just enjoy what we're doing in the moment. I think that is sometimes enough. You know, this podcast. We made it to 10 episodes. Who'd have thunk?
Stamps.com is calling our name.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to, make sure we plug in the intro here is talking about Original Gravity and where to find Keith. And I think we will link to his website. But Original Gravity is how I was introduced to Keith. And he has been finding intersections between beer and music for a long time. And we realized in researching and chatting that we have a mutual friend in Greg Carlson, the head brewer of Redemption Rock Brewing Company, which we talk about. And we should also plug. And then if you're in Worcester, you should go there. And if you are not, you should seek their beers out. They are exemplary.
That they are. I miss Greg. Good guy.
I also miss Greg, and I think we should have Greg in the podcast. We should, he is the co-host of the Original Gravity podcast, it would seem. And we should talk to him about his beer, and we should make him play kazoo.
I'm pretty sure he would be down for playing kazoo. Yeah.
I've got an extra one here, so.
Yeah, and when you're fully vaccinated, we can get back to the full life of kazoo sharing that we all used to live before the pandemic.
I've got enough kazoos for everybody. They can have their own.
But that's part of the fun, Matt, is sharing. Sharing is caring.
Mm-hmm.
True. That's true. What better way to end an intro than with that beautiful, beautiful words of wisdom from Dennis.
Enjoy, Keith.
Enjoy.
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You guys already pour your beers?
I just did, like right now.
I have to admit, my pour is not great. I thought, Keith, about going to that. I have a wide mouth Abbey glass, but I'm rocking your first suggestion, DuPont, first.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, see, it's kind of the better order to do it is DuPont and then the triple, but I don't know. If I'm only going to have one, it's going to have to be this.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, cheers.
Cheers, man.
Cheers. I do not have a wide mouthed Abbey glass, so.
I have this ridiculous love of Belgian glassware. And like there was several years where I was trying to collect every glass of any Belgian beer I might ever want to serve. And I did okay, but I mean, I also had to stop at some point because I was like, this is getting out of control.
Well, the physical glassware collection and the physical media collection behind you and existing in a world as in which we live, they cannot always coexist.
Yeah. Yes. This is true.
I do appreciate the mead hall, desire to serve the beer only in the glass that it is intended.
Appreciate that. And it's, I mean, I like it myself, but it's also fun anytime there's a guest over and they're like, oh, I'd like, you know, fill in the blank. It's like, oh, well then can only serve Fantôme in a Fantôme glass.
Good eye, sir. Good eye. There's a Saison that I wish I could reliably pick up in a small vessel and rely on it being anything like the same beer the three or four times I had it that it like blew my mind and yes. Not the other times I had it.
Yeah. Good. It yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like reliably like get it. You can do that, but then the rest of it, you can't do that.
That's true.
I've got a Fantôme bottle sitting in the basement, which the basement is just the cabinets behind me, but like I'm terrified to open that thing, but I also like know it's going to be an event one way or the other.
Yeah, I had to dump one not long ago over Christmas. I was with some friends and we cracked open their Fantôme de Noël and it was undrinkable. Like, and then I had the same beer 2 weeks later with a different friend and it was amazing. And I was like, how is this possible? It's crazy.
I read an interview with Danny once and he said it was heavily edited and translated, but he claimed to only drink West Flettern 12 and never drink any of his beers. Yeah, well, maybe once in a while you might want to
test it just to see. Oh, that's funny.
We should get him a book on QA or something so we can at least start running through a little bit for it.
So he can like fire his wood-fired brewery with a QA book. Yeah, that sounds right. I actually don't know if it's a wood-fired brewery. So in case there are real Fantôme nerds out there, I don't want to misrepresent myself. It looks like one.
It could be. I mean, it very well could be.
There is wood in Belgium and likely in that brewery.
And it's very old school, mm-hmm. So very possible.
So welcome. We typically talk about beer and music. I understand that you also have a habit of connecting beer and music.
I do. I do.
Our friend, mutual friend Jay, introduced us a while back, and we were able to bring some beer out to an event I attended in Brookline. I can't remember the name of the venue.
It was a yoga studio, Innerspace. And that was for the opera, right?
Yes, it was an opera. I remember being there with Will Myers and yeah. It was a very, I think I walked in, I didn't see the beginning of it.
Yeah.
And it was very, very out there. It was cool. I did not know what was happening.
It was easily, I think, the most fun program we ever did. So the piece was by Kate Soper, who's a composer in Connecticut primarily, but she came up for the performance. This opera is a piece that only she has ever performed in entirety. So this was the first time she had seen somebody else do it. She wanted to be kind of incognito and not have anybody point out that she was there amidst the world of, new classical music. She's kind of a big deal. So she's like, I don't want people to know that I'm here. But then what made it so fun is like, most of the people there actually probably wouldn't have necessarily known who she was. I mean, there were people there who did, but the wide majority of the people just kind of came because it was a cool event. Then pairing each aria, so each movement of the opera with a different brewer, and then having that brewer, you know, listen to the piece ahead of time, kind of come up with why they were going to pick this beer, give a little spiel about it. And the brewers went so into it. Like Will in particular wrote like a novel.
Not surprised.
Just like all the reasons he was picking this beer, and maybe it was going to be this one, but then he decided to do this because of this. And it was so fun to kind of blend all of these just seemingly separate worlds into one kind of unified event. And yeah, it was so, 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 so fun.
I mean, I feel like that's something you have tried to make your brand. So I will introduce you. Keith Kirchhoff is the director of the original Gravity Music Series. Call it director. Is that the right title?
Yeah. Artistic director.
Yeah. You know, you work in a lot of brewery spaces and other spaces that'll basically let you put on these shows. You're also an amazing pianist. Do you play anything else as well besides that? That I'm, you know, I feel like I know that I'm missing stuff. I read your bio, but then also forgot to like pull my notes out. So, you know, we're just going to wing it from this point on since we've known each other for quite a few years.
Just fly by the hip.
Exactly.
No, I'm a pianist. Just a pianist. Although over the pandemic, I've been getting really into harpsichord, but I am not a harpsichordist. So it is a hobby at the moment.
Classic story, sourdough and harpsichord. Everyone out there is going to
recognize that. Everybody's doing it, right?
You're the reason the harpsichord store has been sold out for months.
I know. It took me ages to get one.
They had one and you bought it.
Everybody's pandemic.
What is the mental gymnastics you have to go through to translate something that you know so well in an instrument like a piano into the harpsichord? Is there mental gymnastics required?
There is. There absolutely is. Like, they're totally different instruments, even though like the basic idea is the same, that you're playing keys with 10 fingers. But they're really, really quite different. So, because basically everything, all the tools I use to be expressive on the piano are gone on a harpsichord. So there's no dynamic control, for example. You have pretty much one timbre. Every string sounds basically the same. And so so that already, just like, how do I be expressive on an instrument that, it's my tools are gone. And then also the keys are smaller and the action is ridiculously light. So it's easy to miss notes. Like, I'm constantly hitting extra keys. It sounds sometimes like I have never played a keyboard instrument in my life. And I'm like, oh my God, are my fingers just that fat? Like, what is this? So it just takes such a different type of like digit control. And it's fun. Like, it's as a pianist, I've always loved the harpsichord. Just this idea, though, is just fun to kind of approach rep that I wouldn't get to play otherwise on the piano, and then just exercise a different part of my brain and know that it's, you know, my hobby instrument. So I'm not planning on touring with a harpsichord, but it's just, I don't know, it's been fun sitting right next to me over here.
So if a harpsichord were a beer, what kind of beer would a harpsichord be?
Pilsner.
Okay.
It's got to be a Pilsner.
Let's defend that position for a second.
So. Yeah. So I first old, you know, it's an old keyboard instrument and we have an old style, not the oldest style, but it's not a new world style. Harpsichord is so transparent. You make any mistake on a harpsichord and people hear it. Like, you can't hide. There's absolutely nowhere to hide. Super exposed. And a Pilsner, I think, is probably the most exposed beer out there. It's just so basic, and any flaw is just like a highlighter right in front of you, and one sip and you know, is this good or is this not good? And one moment in listening in a harpsichord, you're like, oh my God, who is this person? Or wow, like, this is actually really interesting.
You know,
that was a very well defended position. Sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wasn't sure where that was going to go, but that was, you kind of nailed it perfectly. So
yeah.
And I'll, what does that make the piano for you then?
I don't know. A piano has, like, piano is more, there are ways to hide, but it can, it still is revealing. I don't know. Maybe a porter. Like, if they're bad enough, it's still going to be obvious, but, but it's, there's a little bit more soft corners. Yeah.
I like that. We're really here after asking the hard questions.
I know, man, now I've got to, I don't know if I'm going to be able to keep going on this track, but we'll try.
I feel like this is my like Memorial Dennis joke of him not being here for this session, but does that make like Pro Tools and a computer like New England IPAs for shitty EDM music? Like any asshole can make.
Hey.
The best ones are clearly the best ones and very enjoyable. The other ones are just like, yeah, whatever. They're in the background and no one gives a shit.
Yeah, either that or like a barrel-aged stout, like pastry stout that's just has, you know, crap ton of stuff thrown in it. And you're like, oh, this is nice, I guess. This is like, but if it's really great, you'll know. But otherwise, it's like,
Interesting. Background music, almost. Some of that music is for me. I haven't really explored anything like what you just described musically. But I also don't know enough about, you know, your compositions, Keith. So I kind of want to get into that. And I know that like as part of Original Gravity, you've like directly connected beer and music and musicians and artists. But what was your musical journey to kind of set that table a little bit?
Sure. So I grew up in Minnesota and was one of these weird kids that just pretty much from the beginning knew that I wanted to be a pianist. So my parents didn't have a piano. Neither of them are musicians, but I was asking for lessons and asking for a piano around age three. And they weren't able to find a teacher for me until I was about five. And then started in with a teacher and never really wavered, like always just kind of knew that's what I wanted to do. Got in with a particularly like high level teacher in middle school. His name was Paul Wirth. And that was a pretty intense studio that was awesome. I mean, I loved it. I soaked it all in. And so he was the type of teacher who has had numerous child prodigies. I am not, by the way, a child prodigy. I'm just a kid who was esoteric and worked his butt off. But he had a lot of child prodigies. And he made pretty clear early on when I went with him, he's like, are you sure you want to be a, you know, professional classical pianist? And spent weeks trying to dissuade me. And when I couldn't be dissuaded, it was like, all right, then we're going for it. So bad news, you're way behind. And, you know, he pretty much made me swear off any extracurricular activities. He was putting me in, you know, I was in every competition under the sun, practicing 8-10 hours a day, got out of school early to get home and practice. My parents were kind of concerned that, you know, they were raising somebody who was, let's say, rather imbalanced. But I loved it. Like I was happiest in lessons with him, happiest playing in contests and giving concerts and meeting other kids who were doing stuff like that, which was, you know, the only way to find them was to go to these competitions because they sure as heck weren't in school with me. And so, you know, went off to University of Oregon for college, still pretty intent on doing it, finished grad school out here in Boston, New England Conservatory, and then was like, oh, well, now I guess I have to figure out how I'm going to do this. I don't know what I'm doing. I've just been playing piano. So that's when, you know, kind of redefining my career, or actually not redefining, there was no career to redefine, just like actually defining and figuring out what it was that I was doing. And throughout all of that, like, education time, I was very interested in new music. So experimental classical music, music being written by my contemporaries. And that was an area that seemed to have less competition. I mean, it's still a lot of competition, but it's not, you know, there aren't as many people vying for those types of jobs and gigs. But even still, there were a lot. And so I started to kind of become even more specific to do classical music with electronics, that combined electronics and piano. And there were really very, very few people that were doing that. And there really weren't many instrumentalists at all who felt comfortable running an electronic setup as well as being, you know, the full concert musician. So that's kind of where my career sort of settled in terms of my own solo work and touring. And then since, you know, I've got a couple different ensembles here in town, and then run the Original Gravity concert series as a way to be more connected in the community itself. And, you know, a way to promote the awesome music that's going on here to people who probably don't know it. And yeah, so there's the story in like 2 minutes.
So when you, knew you wanted to play piano, like what, were your parents listening to a lot of classical or mm-mm. were they listening to like pop music and this was you like early rebelling?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Like they listened to Rolling Stones a lot. They listened to a lot of new age music, which I never liked as a kid. And I definitely don't like now. there was no classical music in the house. They have no idea what on earth would have compelled me to want to do that. The only thing they can think of is Bob from Sesame Street. That's the only time I would have seen even come into contact with a guy who plays piano. So I don't know. It's just one of those weird, weird things. It's like, wake up and just like, yeah, that's what I want to do. And that just kind of is how it worked out. And there's no real explanation for it, but
I don't know. Children's Workshop is awesome.
It is awesome. It's super awesome. And actually going back and watching a lot of that, it's like, yeah, actually, I don't know if Bob is what did it, but Bob is awesome. So yeah,
that's,
I don't know.
That's pretty just amazing that like, I can't even imagine it like knowing what I want to do right now. And you're just like nailed it at like 3. You're like, let's go.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's kind of weird. I mean, on the downside, you know, I guess I didn't, you know, I missed out on certain things that I could have been doing like for that well-rounded, you know, high school background, you know, didn't do theater, didn't do any sports, didn't do, you know, it's like just did piano, but I still look back on it and think those were some of the most fun years where I really had nothing to do with just play piano all day. It's pretty awesome.
So when did the beer creep into the picture? Because for everyone listening, you are a home brewer as well.
I am. Yep.
So at what point did beer start creeping into this picture?
So the one of the things about being a classical musician is you get to hobnob with a lot of very wealthy people. And when you, and so I got, you know, as a student, I often got, you know, kind of shelled out to do background music for various events and gigs and fundraisers and auctions. And in addition to getting paid, you would also get fed well. And I kind of developed into a bit of a foodie. Really loved great food, great wine, but I was also really poor and couldn't afford anything remotely resembling a halfway decent bottle of wine. But beer, like great beer, was actually quite affordable. Like the best beer I could possibly get, even if I couldn't afford that every single day, I could definitely afford it. And that was sort of what drew me in, was it was actually accessible to, you know, a music student who was actually really interested in interesting flavors. And, you know, I think Belgian beer is what drew me in very first. First time I had tasted something like that, I actually remember it was a Leffe at a music festival in grad school. And I had never had anything like it. And I was like, damn, this is amazing. And like, it was kind of no turning back from there. So, and then out here, when I moved, I lived in Los Angeles for a while. And when I moved back to Boston, I started to connect with what was then kind of a blossoming and growing craft beer scene. Got to know a bunch of the local homebrewers, many of whom now are successful professional brewers in their own way. Worked at a lot of various festivals like Beer Advocate and Drink Craft Beer, and that's how I met Jay, was at a Beer Advocate festival. And, you know, it just kind of became a neat way to interact on one level that like everybody did completely different things and everybody came from completely different backgrounds. And yet we all had this like obsessive love of craft beer and especially the local brewers. And it made it an interesting and great just kind of, yeah, commonality. And then, you know, then we were all home brewers too. So we were able to kind of play off of each other and learn from each other. And it was cool.
I'm curious, did that passion that you shared with those folks, you know, over craft beers, over beers that you're making, beers that you're kind of like geeking out over, like how that led to the desire to like expose more people to the passion that's like your day job, you know? And it seems to me that there's a similar amount of passion with which you talk about both those things.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, Original Gravity definitely did. It did come out out of this shared craft brewery love. You know, it's as many of my friends in particular were thinking they were going to open up breweries themselves. You know, it's like I tossed around the idea for a half a second or two, but I was like, that's not what I'm doing. And unlike them, I actually love my job. I love what I do. And so it was sort of a twofold thing. It was, like you sort of implied, like a way to share what I do with all of this other group that has, you know, I could tell them what I did, but they had no real concept of it. But also it was a flip where it was a way for me to promote what they were doing with musicians who didn't really know. You know, I think at this point, the idea that, you know, we know that a lot of Boston knows their local craft brewers. I don't think that's a hidden gem anymore. But, you know, when we first started, you know, Aeronaut was not yet opened and they were our first big sponsor. And it was, we kind of worked out a deal. They were going to host us for the entire first year. And, you know, they were looking to be involved in the community and definitely people didn't know what Aeronaut Brewery was. And so it really did kind of benefit everybody. We brought a whole new audience to Aeronaut. I think Aeronaut probably would have been fine without us, but you know, still like we introduced a lot of new people to what they were doing. And then we were also able to introduce people to what we were doing by using that space and using them as that gateway. People are like, oh, what's this cool hip new brewery that's doing what? Like, what is, you know, what is this weird concert thing? Cool. And so people came in we're able to hear this stuff. And I don't think that would have been had the same appeal without that, you know, craft brewery partnership.
I think Aeronaut has actually won some awards for their taproom programming over the years, and they've done a really great job of it. I know that friends of my wife are involved in their like trivia night where it's independent trivia where people can come in and like host their own trivia night and like,
yeah,
you know, it seems like they've been very progressive on that front and really cool to hear how you guys partnered.
Yeah. They've been crazy progressive, like they do, and supportive of local artists and local musicians of every genre and every medium, you know. So it's, you know, they did not shy away from experimental classical music, but they also have done normal classical music. They've had Beethoven symphonies performed in that space. They do local bands, they do jazz nights. I mean, they really double down on being a hub for local artists. And I think that's awesome. And, you know, and also the level that they supported us. Our second concert, for example, we came under our budget of what we were hoping for. And not only did Aeronaut never charge us for their space, but that night they actually donated the difference that we were shy. And you know, they wiped our bar tab. They were like, here's the money that you were hoping to make. And for a really young arts group, like that's our second concert and we were already in the hole. And now we left like at even. That was amazing. I still applaud that and am amazed know, because they're also still, they were a super young brewery. I'm sure they didn't have a ton of petty cash just to like throw around willy-nilly, but they believed in us and that really made a difference and really mattered.
Yeah. On the other side of that coin, I know from being at that first concert at Aeronaut, you talk about, you know, playing piano for a very highbrow society. I think a lot of the people there who, yeah, there were people there that obviously came for that, but that first show, I think people just came to Aeronaut and they were just like, what is going on? Yeah, we'll check this out. And we're, I don't want to say confused at times, because there was some avant-garde stuff there for a little bit, but there were definitely some like, well, this is definitely interesting, that you wouldn't normally have that crowd to be able to be there to react to. So
exactly. And I think that, you know, a lot of the stuff we've done some pretty weird things. Like one of our more popular pieces was a piece for Bode Cactus. We had another one that was, it was one where just there was a narrator just kind of giving this really weird story about beef jerky while this clarinetist was sort of playing some weird, like, I don't know, just really abstract stuff. And yeah, so we've gotten out there, but what's great is when you get rid of the pretense or any type of high society or any type of academic hoity-toity type thing, it's just, hey, let's just hang out. Let's have a beer, let's relax, let's chill, and let's listen. And people become really receptive, even if people, you know, sometimes people leave and they're like, wow, this was some of the most amazing music I've heard. And I think that opera that we talked about earlier was one of those situations. Other times people are like, that was really weird. I don't know what I just heard, but it was kind of interesting. And I think putting it in a space like a brewery, putting it with an interesting beer, makes people just relax and take it in, as opposed to going to a concert hall, which might feel foreign to a lot of people already, sitting quietly in a seat that's probably uncomfortable because it was built 150 years ago. And, you know, now you're like, I don't know what I'm hearing. I don't know how to react. I don't know how to respond. You know, it's fine. Like the people's reactions in a, when we do these, it's okay if people laugh. It's okay if people chuckle, because like that's a fine reaction. It's a reaction. And when you feel safe to react however you naturally react, I think it makes people more receptive to it and more excited about it.
I think that there's something about the pop music form that distracts us from the fact that we're experiencing art when we hear it. And, you know, mm-hmm. the art in pop music is different than the art in classical music, but like, you go to a museum and see a banana taped to the wall and someone tells you that it's art, you might think it's weird. You'd still be like, okay, that is art. Someone said it's art and it's in right. a museum. You know, a two-story tall Chihuly glass sculpture, you're like, I don't know why or what. It's cool looking. That's art. But like, people want to like put music into a box, be like, if it breaks the pop form, it's hard to like conceptualize. It reminds you that pop music is art, which is not something that we're always conscious of when we're consuming mm-hmm. it.
I think you, I mean, and by when you're with your mentioning of visual art, modern art museums, people are willing to accept weird shit. Like people, like modern art museums are some of the most populated, you know, art spaces in many, 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 many cities. I know like Tate Modern, for example, in London is one of the most busy museums in the world. And people are willing to go in and see weird stuff and accept it. And even at talk about it and be like, well, that's weird. I don't get this. Why is there a banana tape to the wall? I guess it's art. But you know, you go on to the next thing and it's cool and it's fun and people have a good time, even if they don't want to buy that banana. Like, but when it comes to music, people think, or people's immediate reaction is to be more standoffish. It's like, ah, I don't like whatever. It doesn't even have to be, I don't understand experimental music. It could just be, ah, I don't like country music. Or you had this, I've listened to a couple of your podcasts. You had the ska podcast. It's like, oh, I don't like ska. So you just stop listening. Like before you kind of break, put a block. And when you can get rid of that block, just like people are willing to accept what's in a visual modern art museum, you can get rid of that block. People like way more than they think they like. if it's well produced, if it's well done, most people are going to at least appreciate it, even if it's not something they want to experience every day.
I've led you to the actual point of this episode, which is to defend why Sky is the most primal and beautiful form of music. So now that we're here.
Oh God, I'm out of my element here. I mean, that's what I was going to defend was that there is some really damn good non-alcoholic beer.
We have talked a little shit about
alcohol. You have, and there's some really good stuff. So that I can defend. I still don't know enough about ska to say anything about it.
I don't know enough about non-alcoholic beer to pass too much judgment. So. Other than that,
just talk shit about it on the internet.
That's what the internet's for.
Yeah, this is just a long.
I don't think I've ever talked about the flavor or anything. I've just talked about the people.
Well, you know, people could say that about folks dressed up in black and white checkers, skanking it up at your local, music emporium, if you will. So let's be less judgmental. I think it's a good point. If we're going to love ska punk, we have to also love non-alcoholic beer, or at least accept it.
Accept it. And there is some really good. Yeah, Athletic is just really good.
I think it's just the running joke that we shit on it's Athletic. We actually do not have anything against it in any way whatsoever. No.
I have personally recommended it to folks, and I have never had it. And it has come up in half of our episodes, so
I haven't listened to all of them, so I guess I haven't realized that it's come up more often than
that's perfectly fine. But this is now our Athletic segment, so
there we go. Good,
we'll drop our Athletic ad here.
Yeah, actually they're probably sponsors of this podcast, aren't they?
If you buy 2 6-packs on their website, they shipping is free. The advertisement has showed up on my phone. We've discussed it enough.
I thought you were going to say that they ship you this podcast for free. It just shows up on your phone every time.
You know, at this point, you're going to have to get someone from there on this podcast.
Yeah. Now now we're just dancing around it. We're slowly going to get there. I mean, we're 10 episodes in. We've had 2 sober guests and 1 guest that doesn't like beer.
Right.
So we might as well do it. I'm excited to learn more about it, honestly. I think that it's an interesting category. I think if we're trying to be inclusive and we're trying to talk about how beer holds a place in society that can be really welcoming, I think it's a nice, it would be a nice segue. So,
sure.
I mean, I agree. We make the 2% beer, you know, it's this somewhat similar, like that low alcohol stuff. And I love that. I drink a lot of 2% pills. So
what is, why don't you just drink one beer? It's just
regular. Which one strength. Is your 2% pills?
It's brewery only right now.
Okay, that's why I haven't. That's why I don't know it.
It's hard to get to the brewery these days. You have to do a bunch of things. But it's called 2% Beer Initiative. And under that line, we have done a number of styles, including Pilsner, IPA, brown ale. Cool. I think there was a mild that we called a brown because we were afraid to call it a mild. So,
Keith, who of your homebrewing friends actually makes the best beer?
Oh, man.
That turned into being a professional brewer. The best. So these are compliments. You know, you're just going to upset the people you don't mention.
Ooh, I don't know, man. I don't know.
Why don't we widen it to notables?
I mean, the one that comes to mind first, but he's also just a really close friend of mine. So, you know, I'll just give him a shout out. I don't know if I can say that the others aren't as good.
Are you about to talk about a guy who we used to work with?
Yes, Greg Carlson.
Yeah, where did he learn all that great?
Yeah, Greg Carlson, Redemption Rock. And really, truly, like they did such a good job out of the gate. You know, every brewery that opens, you see, usually the first few beers are, you know, hopefully they're good. Sometimes they're not that great, and you always, hopefully you see an uptick in quality as people get to know their equipment and they get to learn how to brew at that scale. And, you know, Redemption Rock was one of those breweries that just their first batches were really good, and they've also gotten better, but batch one, there was nothing wrong with it. It was damn good. And I remember it was a beer that he had brewed a ton as a home brewer. He had been working for years on this recipe. I was like, Greg, this is so much better. And he's like, it's just finally getting good ingredients, was his answer. I think he undersold himself, but yeah, it's so I'll give a shout out to.
I think that's well deserved. I think Greg and Danny and that team over there have really done a great job. They're a certified mm-hmm. B Corporation in Worcester. You should look up what that means and who they are and drink their beer. And yeah, I've also similarly been impressed. There's somebody because of working with Greg, I probably gave them an early try where normally I would, like you said, kind of wait for a brewery to figure themselves out. And I was really pleased with the results. I think they're a lot of fun. I had an IPA in my fridge last year with a really lovely label. The name is going to escape me.
Their labels are fantastic.
Their labels are awesome. Their labels are great. And they really are such a great, I'm thankful as all hell that they've seems to have weathered the pandemic, because their whole model was to be a community space. Actually not unlike what we were just talking about, Aeronaut, the space for community to go there. And while they were going to have canning as part of their story, it was supposed to be a let's come here, let's share pints. And that when that whole model gets turned on its head, I'm glad people seem to have still been buying their stuff and, you know, cans. And of course, now they're open again.
I think both are. I've seen recent pictures. I think Aeronaut has actually recently opened a cannery.
They bought the old down the road space. Yeah.
And every.
Nice. Good.
Yeah. They're open and strong. So shouts to you. What is it? There's a robot beer.
Yes.
Pilsner, right?
Yeah. That's the one that actually won, best Pilsner at GABF.
Oh,
I forget its name.
We know.
They also released an album on the bottom side of one of their cans once, which I thought that was
awesome. I didn't get to listen to it or try that beer, but I saw they were doing that. I was like, oh my God, that is hyper rad.
The original non-fungible token, I guess.
Yes. Oh no, but don't make this into an NFTs podcast. We can't go there.
I think we're into fungible tokens.
We discuss the blockchain,
and then all of a sudden we watch listenership go plummet down.
I think we made the joke before. I don't know if it made it. I got a cassette as an extra in like a Bandcamp Friday purchase, and I'm like, this is just a fungible token because I'm just going to listen to this band on the internet because I don't have a way to make this music come out of this thing anymore, sadly. So yeah. I think we're pro fungible tokens. We are anti non-fungible tokens.
I condone that.
I think it's kind of impressive that I think cassettes are going to outlive CDs as the thing that like people still make because they're super cheap. You can hand them and be like, here's a physical thing, but just listen to our Bandcamp.
Vinyl seems to be doing well still, but CDs I think have, I don't see CDs staying around.
Yeah, vinyls have a big, beautiful picture. You can display them. The sound quality is still great. You know, CDs serve very little purpose anymore unless you're like in a place where there isn't the internet.
Yeah.
Which does exist, I know.
Well, and there are still, I will still give credit to things like CDs where you get good liner notes. You get, and like I, even though I think it's better on an LP than a CD, I like album art. I like to hold it. I like to read about it or open up the liner notes and see some weird unfoldable poster or some like weird cool thing that they're doing as a visual art presentation to accompany the music. I love it. And you just don't get that on Spotify. You get the music and that is it.
I agree 100%. That's why I still buy records. I still love having that thing that you can hold and the extra touches that bands put into stuff I'll always appreciate that.
One of my earliest memories that still connects me to music is unfolding the gatefold. I don't know which Chicago album this is, but my parents are huge Chicago fans and one of them has a photo of Chicago dressed up as like World War I soldiers. Inexplicably, I don't understand what, and it's like huge. It is like eight panels of LP, and I still will just open it up and look at it. It smells like the house I grew up in, and it is an inexplicable piece of artistic weirdness that I'm like, these guys were, I don't know what was happening besides cocaine, but man.
That's fantastic. Stereo Jacks on Mass Ave and right outside Harvard Square always has like, they find the weirdest album art that they just always plaster either on the wall or in the windows. And you just like, you don't even know what the music is most of the time. You're just like, what, who thought that this was a good idea? And, oh, I love it. But it makes you go inside. So it's cool.
The 5-year-old me found my dad's Guns N' Roses cassette tape, which I don't know if you've ever seen the insert to it, but it is a very graphic lady covered in roses. And I'm just like, I feel like I didn't know what it was. I'm like, I feel like I shouldn't be looking at this. And that was my first experience of like ever opening a cassette and being like, the fuck is this?
Yeah, that's hilarious.
But you looked at it again, didn't you?
Yeah, I didn't know why. Five-year-old, I probably still don't know why. It's like terrifying to look at, frankly.
So I'm curious, as somebody who has a limited understanding of new classical music in particular. I have friends who are classical musicians who I, you know, kind of pepper them and ask them for recommendations now and again. Theirs come mostly from the lens of what the BSO plays, because mm-hmm. that's how I know them. But I'm curious, like, for someone like me that's complete neophyte and like is interested in music and has spent his entire life thinking about music and caring about it, like, what should I be paying attention to and listening to, either artists or pieces of work or things that you find compelling that you would like to share?
Great question. Just listen to my YouTube channel. No, I'm kidding.
well, hey, this, no, please plug it.
No, I mean, it's whatever, but no, there's a few. So I really think there's some amazing music being composed right now. Like, it's this generation of composers is phenomenal, quite honestly. And there's a really brilliant mingling and use of technology, of borrowing from multiple different genres to make it so that a lot of this music is surprisingly approachable. Like, I say surprisingly because one might go into it thinking, oh, I don't, why, how would I possibly understand what is going on in new classical music? But there's a lot, the kernels are there to kind of grab you in. So I'll mention a few. I mean, well, one would be, you know, I've mentioned her a few times now, but just that opera that you helped sponsor and kind of participate in. Kate Soper is fantastic. So she does a lot of vocal music because she is herself a singer. And I would say she's probably writing the most compelling operas out of anybody right now. And they're not ginormous operas that are, you know, don't think Wagner. Like, they tend to be more chamber operas, small groups. They are so good. So good. Every one of them. She's recently premiered virtually, but recently premiered a new one, I think. So I haven't heard that one, but everyone I've heard is fantastic. So I would say that, just to see, you know, and also, you know, the one you saw when we did it, that was Ipsa Dixit. We didn't stage it or anything. It was just kind of, you know, presenting just the music. But when you can see them, you know, fully staged with everything, it's pretty spectacular. One composer who I absolutely love what he does is Per Bloland. And so he would be a composer, I would say, if you are into, especially if you're into noise metal, like, he would be a guy to go to reach for, because so he uses electronics and a lot of stuff, and he borrows from noise very heavily. So there will be a lot of feedback elements. There will be I guess the noisiest thing I've seen him do is amplified Bode music stands. There's a piano piece he wrote for me that we recorded a couple years ago, and it's so fantastic because it's just like this blisteringly virtuosic piano piece with just this grungy, just balls to the wall, like feedback slash metal thing that's just like happening while I'm just wailing along the keyboard. It is ridiculous. It's so awesome. He's really spectacular.
What is that called?
That piece is Los Marmillitos. And it's a smaller version of a piece he just finished recently, which is going to be about a 15-minute version of that. And I've got the score. I haven't really dug in yet, so there's no way to hear the full version. But it was basically, I was supposed to be touring with this piece, and he wasn't done. He's like, oh, well, let's make a small version of it. And so we got it done early in that way, and I was able to take it around. If you're into more groovy things, you want to be toe tapping, but in no way unintelligent, just like you want to move. It's like, wow, this is cool. That would be Dan Van Hassel. So he's local. He's actually played on several Original Gravity shows. He's an electric guitarist, and he and I are in an ensemble together called Hinge. And I've been, he and I went to school together, but I have been loving his work ever since he was a student. And actually, my number one played track on Spotify is a piece of his called Lush Intrinsic. It was written in 2009 for piano and electronics. That piece is very just, it's beautiful, lush. I mean, as the name implies, you play a lot with kind of piano delays, but he's got pieces that are just groovy. He's got a really fun piece. You can find it on YouTube called Ghost in the Machine, where he sets up four different percussion instruments. So a snare drum, a couple of different cymbals, and a tom, a floor tom, and puts transducers on there on each of them. And there's a computer that's listening to how we are playing as a quartet, and then we'll send sound into all of those various percussion instruments. So they are sort of playing along with us, even though it's just the computer controlling the percussion instruments. So cool. So cool. His music is fun. It's brilliant. It's great. If you want music that's just, you want to kind of contemplate. So you want to have maybe a deeper listening experience, or you want to slow down your inner rhythm, because actually everything I've mentioned so far is not going to slow down your inner clock. Marty Epstein, local composer. She's based at Berkeley / Boston Conservatory. She really explores the very soft sides of music. It's oftentimes very focused on kind of weaving, intertwining harmonies that just are just perfectly placed, but they're so soft, so that you have to, you immediately lean in. And you're struck with shifting colors and shifting harmonies. It's really great. It tends to be a little longer. It's probably not in any way more or less accessible than anything else I mentioned, but probably requires more like active listening. Background music, you just won't hear it. So there's a cool few to get.
Yeah,
to
that's
start.
Great. I'm curious. This is maybe a dumb question, but I'm going to ask it because we accept dumb questions.
We'll let your listeners decide if this was a dumb question.
Right. just the terminology of new school classical, you know, there seems to me to be a contradiction there. And I'm curious what these composers do that puts them in the genre of classical. Mm-hmm. Obviously they're active and playing now, but like maybe unpacking more of what that genre means to Man, somebody who doesn't know what he's talking about, which is
true. it's actually a great question, and one that doesn't have great answers, because anything I would say, anything I am about to say, because I'll still do a really shitty attempt at answering it, but like you could probably poke holes through everything I'll say. But so one, you know, one thing I think that still defines quote unquote classical music is that it is concert music. So it's concert music designed for intentional listening. So you are where, you know, hopefully all music to some extent is concert music. Like you want to go to concerts, but there is that idea that you're going to listen carefully to something. So it means it's probably in an ideal performance situation. It's in a soft, you know, it's a quiet environment. You're able to just listen, you know, there's not noise pollution kind of getting in the way. So there's one thing. Another thing, although this is one that's easily you can poke holes in, but I'll say it anyhow. The idea that it is something that is written down and that is intended for others to play, and that others to play for a long time. Like in theory, we could be playing it for, you know, centuries still. Most of us probably, I mean, most of the pieces probably won't be, but still the idea is you write it down and a composer is communicating their wishes, their thoughts, their musical ideas onto paper. And then that paper is handed to a series of performers who may or may not involve that composer, and they are interpreting it. So that I think is still at the heart of a lot of this music. Again, not all. And then, you know, there is, I think this one's also going to be one you can poke a thousand holes in, but there is a kind of continued lineage, I guess, of, you know, of study, I guess. Who did people learn from? Who did they study from? Who did those people learn from and study from? And who did they learn from and study from? And eventually you're on to Beethoven. You know, it's, and not that, I mean, that's maybe the worst definition ever, because there's plenty of people who, you know, who can come to classical music without having that type of instruction. But it's, you know, there still is that type of study and time devoted both to the art of writing it and then the art of performing it. So pretty much all of the performers are people who have, you know, studied at enormous length for enormous number of hours, like how to play their instrument. And, you know, the music that is being produced is not in all cases, but in many cases, if not most cases, not playable by people who haven't studied their instrument at a high level. So I guess those are my three really horrible unofficial definitions of what, what makes,
I mean,
what makes it still classical.
It's a pretty good answer when you think about, you know, or, you know, what the music they were making back, those composers were making, it obviously wasn't called classical when they were making it. So,
mm-hmm. Well, it's not really called classical now either. Like I use the term because I feel it's the best way to at least create some idea in whoever is hearing me talk about it, some idea of what to expect. Yeah. So modern classical music tends to be called new music. But that's also kind of a lame term if you're not in the field, because like literally any piece that was, or any song that was just written is new, right?
I mean, nu metal went over real well. So really you should definitely co-opt that.
Yeah, it's not my term, but that's, you know, sort of what it tends to be called. I mean, we get a lot of musicians, a lot of, again, quote unquote, classical musicians who also kind of don't like that label. They don't want to be considered classical musicians, even though they are maybe coming out of that tradition, but they want to blur the boundaries and blur the lines of what their music is. And they think, rightly so, that their music is really attractive to other people, but they're not going to listen to it if it says classical, but they are going to listen to it if it says something else. Dan Van Hassel is one actually who I mentioned just a little bit ago. He and I have had this conversation a lot. I mean, he really rejects the term of classical music. He rejects the idea that he is a classical composer or that Hinge is a classical ensemble, even though I think it fits that box, but he prefers to think, no, we're really blurring lines as much as possible. He's also transcribed a bunch of Bjork tunes and Meshuggah tunes. And like, he's trying to bring other, you know, other genres into whatever genre he likes to be called. So it's really, I don't know, there isn't really a good answer for what it is, but I think it's by calling it, putting it under that umbrella, it still tells people, oh, people studied this instrument kind of like an Olympic, you know, athlete studied their craft, and it probably is played at a concert hall. Like, it's, you know, it at least gives you some idea.
There aren't any good like classical house shows, you know, just in the basement. It's like, we're going to do this classical piece tonight, guys. I mean,
there are actually. There are. Like, there's a fantastic organization called Group Muse. It's that came out of Boston. It's now international. And they basically have brought back the salon idea, which is very much the classical version of the house concert. And they are not doing new music. I mean, they might be doing new music, but you might hear Bach and you might hear Beethoven and Mozart in your living room for a concert of seven people. I've got my harpsichord down here right next to my basement bar. And once we can go back to having people, I have every intention of having 10 people over to sip some beer, some cocktails, and like whip out some Handel. Like, that sounds, it sounds amazing. You know? So yeah, like house concerts, like it's there. It's just very different than what, yeah, house music normally implies.
I grew up calling a Handel a 1.75 liter bottle of liquor. So, whipping out a Handel with some Handel sounds.
Hey, there you go.
Handel right. And Handel.
Yeah.
You know, something you said about classical music makes me think about the lineage that we look to in craft beer, because I think craft beer also suffers from an image. That it's finding difficult to shake, especially like looking at what we do at Jack's Abbey. We try to make, I think we are successful in making, for the most part, like classically inspired German lagers. And we're looking to a tradition and we're trying to speak to that. Where some people hear craft beer and they're like, yeah, I don't like strong beers, or, you know, I don't like hoppy beers, or
yeah,
what have you. So I feel like there's definitely like a parallel between those two things.
I think so. I think the craft beer movement has been fantastic and has brought a lot of people into beer. But I also think it has an image that a number of different images that could be hard to shake. I mean, it's a lot of it, I think, is, you know, I think people still oftentimes think of it as kind of the so-called bro dominated thing, the hipster thing, the people who are lining up around the block to get a bottle of some, you know, some whale that they're just dying to get. I don't know. Hopefully, I think some of it might be shifting and changing, but, you know, the untapped culture of, you know, just having a sip of something, rate it one star, but at least now you can get another badge. You know, I think it's
ticker culture is the worst thing.
Yeah. I think there's images that still need to get, yeah, shook off in craft beer for sure.
Yeah. I would take the nerd standing in line for a bottle image over picking pastries out personally, because that's kind of like, I think it shows kind of how you came into this, because it's probably around the same vintage that I came into it, which was like,
yeah,
I want to drink Kate the Great. I have to go grab a calendar page from Todd at the Portsmouth Brewery. Like, that's just how it works.
Right. That is true. And yeah, I definitely stood in line for several things like back in the day, but the culture seems like it's sort of different. I don't know. I'm careful now, because now I'm like, I'm just sounding like that old fart. It's like, oh, well, back when I was a boy, craft beer was in its best space. Only cool people went and stood in line.
Right.
I don't know.
Feel like this does a good job of bringing us to the way that we usually end our conversations. Although I feel like we're going to talk a little bit longer because we can really beer geek out a little bit. But I'm going to ask you to talk about a beer that is really significant to you. And if there's a good story associated with it, that's also great. And then I feel like we can just really geek out about some beer for the last however much we talk.
Yeah, so you prompted me on this question, and
don't give away our secrets.
No, but like I've really given it a lot of thought, and because like I've been able to sip some amazing beer, like that has been just an incredible, almost spiritual experience. The first time I had, well, we mentioned it earlier, but the first time I had West of 12 was one of those experiences. Honestly, the first time I had CBS was one of those experiences. First time I had Cantium was one of those experiences. But when I was thinking about the question of like the experience more than the beer, like I was coming more to like stories that were involving people. Because at the heart of it, what I love most about beer, I think, is it is the most social, and in like at its heart, it really is an inviting beverage. Like you go to any city in the world and you sit in a bar and you order something, you order a beer, and like there's going to be somebody next to you who might be ordering the same thing. It gives you something to talk about. Like you immediately have something in common. And so I've met like awesome people just through having beer. And so the story I thought of first, so I'll just go with, I thought of a bunch of them, but then I was like, no, this is the one I thought of first. So I'll go with this. So it was, I was coming back from some concerts I was doing in Germany and had a layover in Brussels. And I decided I was just going to make it, as long as there was a layover and there was no cost difference, like let's extend the trip a couple days and just actually hang out in Brussels. And So I had started at Motor Lambic and had met this fellow in his probably 60s. He was there with his son, and his son was just kind of hanging out with a bunch of his friends. And this guy like barely spoke any English, and I certainly do not speak a single word of Flemish. But we were both sipping Orval. And he was just so like, he couldn't believe that an American even knew what that was, and was so excited and wanted me to sip other things, and like was talking to his son to translate words every once in a while. And it was just like this great just experience of meeting this just random dude. And so from there, I walked to this tiny little restaurant that I don't remember the name. I was trying to find it. I don't remember it. And it was super, super small. And so I got there and I had to wait for a table, but their bar had two seats. And so I took one of the seats and just kind of sipped some, I don't know, just crazy awesome beer. I don't even remember what it was, but it was amazing. But I noticed there's this fellow who walks in, and everybody seems to know him. He's clearly very popular. Everybody's happy to see him. And he's also waiting for a table, and he's just kind of standing up against the wall. And so eventually I get my seat, and I'm by myself at a table for two. And so I go up to this guy and I was like, hey, you know, I've got this table for two. Would you like to join me? And he was like, no, that's fine. But you know, 5-10 minutes later, he came up. He's like, so were you serious? And I was like, yes, please sit down. And turns out he was, he worked at Cantillon. He was not one of their brewers, but it was like he was the leader, the head of like their historical department or something. So he would give tours. He led the tap room, and one of the most awesome humans I think I've ever met, just fabulous guy. And we ended up hanging out at that table for hours. We closed the restaurant down. It's 1 a.m. We've talked about, he used to live in Boston for a short spell, so like that was kind of fun. By this point, all of the staff is just around our table sipping beer with us. We're all just talking and laughing. He's like, well, should we get another? And I was like, it's 1 a.m. Everybody here is like trying to go home. And everybody was like, no, this is great. You know, so they go down to the cellar. They pick up some, you know, beer that had been brewed specifically for that little restaurant. We all share it. And it was like maybe one of the most magical days of like ever. And all because, you know, we had beer that we were just sitting around and sharing that made us the best of friends for a night. And so, yeah, I don't know. And there were some pretty awesome beers that were had. There was the one they, the partner was, what was it? Alvine? I don't know how to pronounce the name of the brewery. A-L-V-I-N-N-E.
Yeah. I think I know what restaurant you were at. I think you were at The Greedy Glutton, which is Nuitniginif, like N-U-E-T-N-I-G-E-N-O-U-G-H.
That could be it. Have you been there?
I have been there. And Alvine, Danny at Alvine, brews a beer for them. And we had visited Alvine because I love their weird little beers. And he was like,
same.
We were on the way to Brussels. And he was like, you need to go see this place. And it had like
That's
wood
awesome.
Carvings on the outside of it. Like just a beautiful little space. And we also had like a crazy, like long visit there. So this connection is an extension of that connection.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that you've had, like, you know, that bar and that restaurant and you've had that beer, that's awesome. So yeah, I don't know. Beer is quite unique in that way. I don't think there's any other beverage that binds people quite like that.
I mean, the first time I got to meet you was you were hosting, I think, an Oktoberfest party in Roslindale at your old house.
Yep.
And you were popping Doppelbocks that were exploding across the entire yard.
Yes, that is a fact. They were a tad overcarbonated.
A tad. I feel like you had the longest bottle opener possible to just be like, this might, and you just let it go and it would shoot 15 feet across the yard.
Yep. That is correct.
Although I will give you credit, you tried to pour some in a glass after that. You were like, wait, let me pour some for you. And it just hit the bottom and just was foam. You had such high hopes for that little bit of beer.
I did. I was proud of that beer. Even if no one was able to enjoy it.
I mean, we enjoyed it just in a different form.
For sure. No, I love those. Yeah, we used to do these like homebrewer Oktoberfests, and we also did Wheatfest every June, which was that every beer had to be at least 51% wheat. And they were just fun. Like, we would set up like little tables under umbrellas as if we were like some real beer festival, and we would just have the whole neighborhood come by, and they were so fun. So fun.
It's time to recapture those things this year. Think about those things that have connected us and come back to them. So
yeah,
to that image of beer, I toast Belgian beer to you, sir.
Indeed.
I appreciate that. Even if it was we're not drinking Leffe, but Leffe is a really good, like, for me, you mentioned Leffe as an introductory. For me, it was Unibrew something. And it was at the other side of Newbury Street. And I was 20 years old sneaking it from someone else.
Rebel.
I know.
Oh, my gang, Hennepin. So same idea, just from Underbones, because my sister worked there. And so also wasn't 21. And she had one rule. When you turn 21, don't be here, because then they'll know I've been serving you all these months.
That's awesome. Yeah, I don't know. It's a special beer. I mean, that whole culture, that whole,
I mean,
Belgian isn't a style, but it sort of is. Like, it's special.
They're loud beers that look like American beers, you know, like visually you're like, oh, pale beer. And then you're like, this beer is 8% and tastes like bananas and cloves.
Yes.
I haven't had
a Vestmalle triple in forever, but it's so fucking good.
Isn't it good? It's so good.
I like appreciate that you were like, that's what I feel like drinking right now. So I'm like, cool. All right.
Well, spring, it's like, you know, and I'm a very weather dependent like drinker as well. So like spring, I really want to be drinking Saisons, and I was all set to say we should do DuPont, but then it's like cold and rainy. And so you got to drink, you know, a pale beer that's still got a lot of heft.
I just did both. I won't lie.
Well, I'm kind of want to go over to my little fridge and pick up a DuPont, but I know that then I'm going to have to like leave this podcast for a sec. So and I don't know if you edit these.
We actually do.
We do edit these.
Our producer, Dennis.
Good.
You can do that.
Then, if you will excuse me, I won't be more than like 2 seconds.
I got to drink one of those too, but I have to eat dinner and I can't do a DuPont and a West Mall before dinner. That's oh, a no, no.
Well, but DuPont is so small.
I mean, comparatively. Yes. So tiny, 6.5%.
6.5%. It's fine. It's nothing. I had a late lunch. That's why I feel it. I've got
a brought a pizza home from Jack's Abbey and ate it before.
Love this, it. So. Love it. Yeah, no, I, I've been in weird, like body, well, I'm day after my second shot, I should say. I'm like,
cheers, got mine this morning.
Oh, congrats. Congrats.
My second shot.
Where I'm sore and a little like, you know, that like soreness that's in your joints.
Yes.
When you were sick, I'm feeling that. And I'm like, ugh. But yeah. Other than that, I'm fine. So I really can't.
Which one did complain. You get?
I got the Pfizer.
Same.
Yeah, so
same.
Some it has knocked a couple of our coworkers for a loop, but luckily for me, it seems I'm doing okay.
I'll find out next Thursday.
Nice. Are you? No, you didn't have to go to Uxbridge after all, right? You got a local.
No, Heinz Convention Center, thankfully.
Great.
That's right. I whenever I hear Heinz Convention Center, what I hear, because. My brain is stupid, is the guy on the tee saying Heinz Convention Center. And when they moved the ICA, they didn't change his inflection. So he goes, Heinz Convention Center. And then you're like waiting for the come down.
Yeah,
he came down the ICA.
The Heinz was the That's first awesome. Place I went to a show by myself.
Really?
Yeah, so FNX used to do this thing called College Fest, which was like a bunch of crappy booths of like giving you like oxy pads for college kids and like all sorts of stuff. But they would also have like a band play and Real Big Fish was playing, going back to our lovely ska talk. And I was like, I gotta go see this. So like I was in eighth grade, so however old I was then, it's like I have to go see Real Big Fish at the Heinz Convention Center of all places.
Fantastic.
Was it a good show?
Yeah. I mean, 12-year-old me, however old I was,
yeah,
was thrilled. Was out.
Yeah. That's right.
I mean, I'm sure they were fun, right? We were talking about them with Mike Bark. They were like, of any other band, they've been doing it for so long and so consistently.
Also, I mean, this was, you know, 20 years ago when they weren't as cheesy. Like they were a little like, they were like tongue in cheek, like cheesy. Now they're just like full, like we're a wedding band, ska band, cheesy now, which is, you know, we like do like covers of Wham and stuff. Like that's who they've become.
Yeah.
Well, hey, we are a pro ska punk podcast. Let's remember.
Look, I love Real Big Fish. I'm just saying they've changed who they are. That's all.
Mm.
And that's fine. You know, whatever.
So have you, sir. So have you. You're no longer 12.
That's very true. I can drink now.
Yeah. Congratulations.
It's big day.
So did you go get a West Mall triple there?
No, I got the DuPont. I started with the West Mall. Yeah. Yeah. I should have done it the other way around.
I followed the same order and it was just fine. I started West Mall and hit the Saison.
That Saison Spice Baby. We're actually recording this, I think, a day or two after Saison.
Yeah, yesterday was Saison Day,
which
I didn't know until Matt told me. So
yes, which, you know, another, you know, apparently beer advocates, the hallmark of beer holidays, I think, because it's like, it's Saison Day. Hey,
definitely.
Get your loved one a Saison and a card. But
I actually had it was fun. I have a close friend that somehow had never had Saison DuPont, and I poured them a bottle of it a couple weeks ago, and they were like, "What? This is what I've always wanted in a Saison." And I was like, "Yes, this is the best Saison."
Yeah, this is literally the Saison that we use as a measuring stick for everything else.
I would have understood if they said like, "I've never had a Saison before," but to be like, this is what I've always wanted a Saison to be. Like, this is what a Saison is.
They had brought over
starting point.
A couple weeks before that, they had brought over a local brewery's Saison, which was not good. So then when I poured this, I was like, oh, see, this is a Saison. Like, oh my God. Oh my God. Yeah. I like it even better though in the green bottle, I have to admit. Like, in the tall format, get a little bit of the light skunkiness in there, and now it sings. But even it's like this.
It's just a pretty little beer. It's not, I mean, you said it was little. I just called it little, but it's still 6%.
It is 6.5%. It's bigger than I remember it being.
But it comes in the little 33 centiliter bottle, so it looks little.
Yeah.
They make a lovely winter beer of Vec de Bon Vaux.
Yes.
I think that one's like 10%.
Yeah, it's big.
That beer is lovely. Not that this beer isn't lovely.
It's fantastic. When I lived in Boston, I would always try to get over to Public House whenever they would put that on. Just because, it's fantastic. The first time I had it, though, I don't know what I was expecting. I remember being really surprised by it. It was just like this like mental dissonance. It's like, wait a minute, this isn't what I thought this was going to be. Well, I think I was somehow expecting I was probably expecting St. Bernard's Christmas beer or something. And then it was like, not remotely that. I was like, what is this?
That's another great beer. I think is just AB 12 plus spices.
Yeah. I love that beer. And actually what kind of brought me back into Westmalt Triple is I had picked up over winter St. Bernard's Triple and was just like being like, oh my God, I forgot how good this is. This might be the best triple. And then I picked up Westmalt. I was like, no, Westmalt is still the best triple.
It is great.
Yeah. I've just been all back on Belgium I think also like with pandemic stuff, when I can't travel, I've been really enjoying drinking things that remind me of my travels. That like the flavor of it just brings me to another place. These beers do that for sure.
To me, there's a double-edged sword to that in the beer culture we're in now. And you know, having ultimate world access to any beer you can imagine at your fingertips at your local store, I think is fantastic. Because you can visit a trip you had in the past by picking up something you had. At the same time, I feel like it does kind of like, when you go to any store in the country now and you can switch the brand names, but it's, you know, it's X local hazy IPA and a ever more dusty bottle section. I feel like going to the Pacific Northwest and drinking Cascadian Dark Ale isn't as interesting. It doesn't have the same impact when you can just go to the store and buy something just like it, you know? I'm working it out because I still want that access.
I mean, I hear that, but like, I think part of the experience is when you travel is you can, and that's another great thing about beer, especially in this country. It's like right now, like you can go anywhere and there's going to be a brewery. Hopefully they're a good one. They may not be a good one, but they're probably a decent one. And so you can get that Cascadian Dark Ale, but you go to the source, you know, you maybe meet the brewer, you meet somebody who works there who's really excited about it, or you just meet the person who goes there every Thursday afternoon because you're just sitting at the bar next to them and you end up chatting with them forever. Like, it's, I don't know, like I stopped my early trips to Belgium, I was always bringing home stuff, and I don't know, maybe 6-7 years ago I just stopped. I was like, I'm not bringing things home anymore, no matter where I travel. Unless it's Mexico and I'm bringing home a skull, I'm not bringing home things, because it's like part of the fun is when I'm in Germany, I can drink the best German beer. But when I'm in Belgium, I should be drinking the best Belgian beer. And when I'm in the US, I should be drinking the best American beer. And I live in a place that has amazing beer and I should be taking advantage of that, says the guy who's, you know, went to a store and bought DuPont. But like,
well, we need you to do that. And we need other people to go to the store and along with their 4-pack, grab a bottle of something, because these things aren't going to exist here in bottles if people don't.
No.
Every once in a while, you got to treat yourself to something like this, you know?
Yeah, that's absolutely, you know, it. And I want to see stuff. I mean, I'm a little nervous now that, you know, Shelton Brothers kind of went under. Like, I'm nervous how we're going to get some of this stuff. I mean, Westmalt is fine. That's not Shelton Brothers, but, you know, Fantôme is. Or was, you know, Destruce, I think, was. Yep. You know, so how are we going to get that? And I don't know. Like, I love that. Well, I love the Struce. I Fantôme I buy, but now and then. like we said earlier, it's like, you never know. But at its best, it's amazing.
I just saw a recent post by a local publican who posted an email that they received from somebody at the Shelton Brothers being like, reports of our death have been over exaggerated. Like, here's a list of inventory. Most of these beers should be fine. I was like, okay. Interesting.
Curious.
Yeah. So that's a little nugget for the buried deep in the podcast here that maybe they're still selling beer. Somebody's trying to.
Curious. Huh. Yeah. I've been trying to kind of keep tabs on like the local stores that I know sell Shelton Brothers products to kind of just look to see what the shelf inventory looks like. And if it does start to get really low, just be like, all right, well, here goes that paycheck. Hey. I don't know.
But I mean both, someone's gonna pick fortunately up that and unfortunately that stuff doesn't fly, so
no, it doesn't. That's the
no. thing. But then also usually get better on a store shelf at room temperature. So that's depending on the style, of course. But
well, exactly. Like that's why I'm not like keeping a whole bunch of those things to sell it here. It's like, yeah, let them sell it for me and then when I want it.
So long wait till they discount it and it's, you know,
it gets even better. Well, so there's, you know, so I
so much Panapod I've bought for like $4 a bottle. I'm like, oh yes.
Oh my God. I just opened one of those the other night. Freaking love it. I live in Providence and there's a great store, Nikki's just down the street. And they don't do the discounted stuff. They have their vintage aisle where they'll like just pull out stuff from 2009, 2010. And they're just like, and now we're going to charge you premium price for it, but it's been taken really well care of. Like it's really good. Yep. It's a pretty fun and pretty dangerous aisle down that store. I
mean, that's like the opposite of miscellaneous, like Towns Wine and Spirits being like, here's a Bigfoot vertical. I'm like, where have these been? Like, what upkeep are you doing? Or have these just been buried in the back or on a shelf or something? I don't trust any of this.
You've been in enough liquor store backrooms and basements to know.
I have.
Where it's been. It's
basically been my life for 7 years. So I know the places where I feel okay buying that.
Nikki's is definitely one. Nikki's is a place.
Nikki's is great. Stuff. Nikki's is so great. It's fun. Like it started just as the place that was kind of nearby. That's like, oh, well, they've got some good stuff. And then like spending time in there, I'm like, oh my gosh, actually this place is amazing. Great beer selection. You know, I'm also quite into cocktails and I already mentioned Mezcal. They've got the best Mezcal selection that's not Ball Square or Julio's. They've got every possible bar addition you could want. Like they've got everything there. Just fantastic beer in the vintage aisle and they're just cool people. It's like, actually this place is really awesome. So yeah, I like them.
Hey everybody, it's me, Dennis. So the conversation kind of went off the rails at this point and the whole thing just kind of petered out and the guys didn't say like goodbye, thanks for being here, Keith, and stuff like that. So that's what I'm doing now. All right. Well, that's it for this episode. So stay tuned next time for another Our Beer Could Be Your Life. Thank you.
Thank you.